You are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. My name is John Malkin, and this is The Great Leap Forward. Tonight you'll hear an archive interview with activist Brian Wilson. Brian will be in Santa Cruz for a very special event on Thursday, September 8th at 6 o'clock in the evening. He'll be at Loudoun Nelson Community Center for a screening of the brand new film about his life and activism called Paying the Price for Peace. Brian will be answering questions and speaking before the film plays. Again, Paying the Price for Peace is a brand new film about Brian Wilson, and it's playing this Thursday night, September 8th, 2016, from 6 to 9 p.m. at Loudoun Nelson Community Center in Santa Cruz, California. The tickets are $5 and up by donation. Here now is an archive interview I did with Brian Wilson in 2011 when his memoirs were published. Free Radio Santa Cruz is commercial-free, collectively run, and has been operating without a license from the U.S. government since 1995. This program, The Great Leap Forward, has been airing on Free Radio Santa Cruz since 1997. This station thrives and survives with your support. We always accept donations of any amount. They help us maintain and update our equipment. You can send checks in here to help us out. Make checks payable to FRSC. Mail them in to Free Radio Santa Cruz, Post Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. We also accept donations online at freakradio.org. My very special guest on the telephone this evening is Brian Wilson, wonderful peace activist and former resident of Santa Cruz. He has completed his memoir, and I'm so glad that that has happened. He's been working on it for a while. It's called Blood on the Tracks, and it's been published by PM Press. Brian will be beginning a book tour this Friday, and he'll go through Oregon and down the coast to San Francisco, and he'll be here in Santa Cruz on Wednesday, July 20th at Capitola Book Cafe. It's a free event. He'll be reading from his book and signing copies of Blood on the Tracks. That's 7:30, Wednesday, July 20th. And Brian Wilson tried to join the FBI a long time ago. He was drafted and sent to Vietnam by the U.S. government in 1967. He spent about 151 days in Vietnam and had 50 different charges laid against him for things that happened in Vietnam. He later experienced flashbacks of his time in Vietnam as a soldier. He spent a lot of time trying to reform what he calls the criminal injustice system. He's traveled all over the world exploring the damage that has been done by U.S. militarism and warfare. He's been to Iraq, Nicaragua, and El Salvador. In September of 1987, he had a tragic experience where he lost his legs as he was lying in front of tracks trying to stop arms from going to Central America from the United States. And he has for some time focused on farming and localization, limiting his own impact on the world. And largely, his book tour coming up is going to be done by hand-powered bicycle. He was just telling me he has driven his hand-powered bikes about 55,000 miles. Brian Wilson, I want to warmly welcome you back to Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to talk with you again. And great. Thank you for putting your book together. It really wraps up a lot of stories I've heard from you directly and from earlier writings, and it puts it all into one book. Congratulations on completing that.
Yeah, it was 8 years in the making. I mean, 8 years that I was actually trying to write it. Actually, in the morning, sitting down and putting words on paper and trying to put it together. So, yeah, I'm very glad I'm it done, and somebody agreed to publish it after 33 rejections.
Wow, great that you didn't give up at 33.
I thought of it many times.
If people don't know about what happened to you on that day, September 1987, I wonder if you would describe that. That's a central point in your life, and you've been, boy, you know, I'm reading your book, and I'm reminded you've been through a lot of intense experiences in exploring and discovering what you call the American way of life, AWOL, and the impact that that's had on you and having on the rest of the world. Can you describe a little bit of what happened on that particular day?
Well, I have to give it a little context. September 1st, 1987, when I was almost killed, was at Concord Naval Weapons Station, 35 miles west east of San Francisco, the largest Department of War arsenal on the West Coast, where the weapons were coming from that went to Central America under Reagan's policies, and also during the Vietnam War, had gone to Vietnam. I mean, it's been a major source of weapons for many years. But I had been in Nicaragua and El Salvador several times before 1987, and including earlier in that year of 1987. So I had documented lots of massacres, atrocities, murders at the hands of both the Contras that Reagan was funding in Nicaragua, the Contra terrorists, and the El Salvadorian, what they call the Death Squad government. And so I had done conventional lobbying like we were trained and taught, and of course the policies weren't being affected by lobbying, even though they were absolutely unconstitutional, grotesquely illegal under international as well as U.S. law, and unconscionable. So we decided to start a vigil at the base where the weapons were coming from to try to impede their flow to Central America. And we started a vigil on June 10th, 1987, at Concord, on the public roadway that splits the base in half. So we were actually vigiling on a public road where the tracks and the road, a Navy road that parallels the Navy tracks, goes across the road from the bunkers where the arsenal, where the munitions are stored, to the Sacramento River on the other side of the base where the ships loaded them up. So I was there much of the summer watching people get arrested for blocking both munitions trucks and, on at least one occasion, a munitions train. And then I decided on September 1st I was going to do a 40-day water-only fast on the tracks. So I knew the situation. There had been there all summer. The train speed limit was 5 miles an hour. There's 350 armed Marines there, and the local police were regularly monitoring our vigil. And many arrests had been made before September 1st. And so I expected to be arrested, and there were two other veterans with me that agreed to do this 40-day fast. And so we took our positions on the morning of September 1st, which was a Tuesday, around 9 a.m., and I had a little press conference and a little gathering service, and then the first train came about 5 of 12, and we were on the tracks. I wasn't lying on the tracks. I was sitting in a lotus position, and the other two veterans were crouched but on their feet, but all three of us between the rails, and the train brain did something it had never done before, which was it didn't stop and wait for arrests. It not only didn't stop, but it speeded up to accelerate it to over 3 times the 5-mile-an-hour speed limit. And I just didn't get out of the way in time, partially because I was sitting, and the other two jumped clear of danger. One jumped to the left off the tracks completely, but the other veteran jumped straight up and grabbed the cowcatcher railing and then jumped off. And I went under the train, and as far as I know, I'm the only person that's been hit by a moving train at that speed that survived. I have no idea how I survived, but I don't even have a memory of being hit. But I was in the hospital 4 weeks, and it took me a few more weeks to learn to walk, and I just kind of kept doing what I was doing. But with a much broader constituency and more people that knew about what I was all about, and therefore I had even more access to places around the world and around the country to talk about what I know about U.S. policy and my concerns about it. So I'm amazed. It's almost been 24 years, and I'm approaching 70, and July 4th, my birthday, and I'm still active and still hand cycling. So I'm kind of very appreciative to have this, this second life or third life, whatever it is.
Thanks, Brian. You, for some period of time, you focused your activism on the criminal injustice system. You were, for a while, the coordinator for the National Moratorium on Prison Control. You were speaking out against the war in Vietnam. You mentioned you were traveling to Central America. You write in your new book, Blood on the Tracks, that I had tried to change the system from within and discovered that the system as it is structured and valued is the problem. And in the next section, you're talking about going back to the land. And you talk a bit in depth about anarchists and anarchist tradition in social change. You write that anarchists understood that we needed to develop a new kind of consciousness, one that was cooperative rather than authoritarian, based on interconnection rather than Cartesian dualism, ecological rather than mechanical. And I've really appreciated speaking with you in the past about anarchism and how that's affected you. I'd like to hear more about that. And I especially appreciate, Brian, you pointing out this really sort of delicate interplay in anarchy of autonomy and creating social networks. So I'd love to hear more about anarchism in your life and this balance.
Well, I didn't really know much about anarchism or read much about it until the mid-70s. And I knew that I was very uncomfortable with vertical power structures and authority figures. I had, after I had passed the bar in Washington, D.C. in 1972, I started practicing law. I realized I could not even get my body did not want to stand up for the judge when the judge entered the courtroom, which is simply simple protocol. I just didn't stand up, and that was partly because of the emotional load that I had from having followed orders in the military for 4 years and participated in destroying villages in Vietnam with air power, and then observing it and documenting it and protecting the planes, basically, so they could continue doing the bombing. So I knew that I was discovering in me that there was something that didn't feel comfortable about being obedient to authority figures. And then I discovered the Russian anarchists and the French anarchists through their writings in the mid-70s, and I said, oh, yeah, I completely resonate with their basic thrust of not trusting any kind of concentration of power, social, economic, political, what have you. And it does tend to rob our humanity from the responsibility of being interactive with one another rather than being passive in obedience to somebody from above. So anarchism basically means without authority from above. And of course, there's all kinds of people that have different variations of what they call anarchism. But for me, it was this need to discover who I was outside the parameters of the conditioning that I grew up with in a capitalist society, which, as you mentioned, is very individualistic versus community-oriented, and it's very competitive versus cooperative, and it's very what I would call acquisitive rather than inquisitive. So it doesn't promote curiosity. It stifles it. And to me, that just didn't feel right. So I wanted to meet more people who had thought about this and read more. I read Tolstoy, who I greatly admire, especially his book, The Kingdom of God is Within You, which is quite a remarkable, I would call, anarchist position. And that autonomy itself, in the context of being in small groups, of which the Zapatistas represent, I think, a good example today, is important. We've given up our autonomy by being obedient to what I call a power complex. We don't think about it, but we abide by certain mores and rules of society, which is, you know, pretty standard. But when those rules and mores are designed to preserve an oligarchic structure or a privilege structure, then it's very much in the way of any kind of community or individual health or justice. And so, to me, anarchism is I don't even like to define the word too strictly, because I just think of it as without authority from above, and then you can start filling in the details however it suits you. But it is, to me, it has a spiritual dimension, it has a political dimension, a social dimension, an economic dimension, but it requires being very responsible with all your choices and with how you interact through cooperation or resolving conflict with others without resort to violence. And anarchism is thought of popularly as craziness and chaos. It's just the opposite. It's very ordered in its own way. It requires a lot of thought and responsibility, and it's not anything to be taken lightly. It's a very in general, as a structure, if we're going to use the word anarchy, it requires withdrawing your support from vertical authority and actually engaging horizontally rather than vertically with rebuilding a society based on what I would call the four human archetypes: empathy, mutual respect, equity, and cooperation.
Empathy, mutual respect, and cooperation. What was the
equity? Basically, a sense of justice.
Great, great. Wow, thank you.
So, equity, empathy, mutual respect, and cooperation. I think those are pretty much archetypes of human character from even pre hominid mammalian characteristics, I think, but certainly in the Paleolithic period, those were characteristics that, for those who survived, those were the characteristics that were that enabled one to survive. They had to, and as the anarchists, especially Kropotkin in his book Mutual Aid,
Thank you. I'd like to ask you one more thing in the realm of anarchy. In your book, you write that though some anarchists believe in violence as a way of throwing off oppressive power structures, the vast majority reject it as a method, despite popular reputation to the contrary. When I'm speaking with some anarchists these days, the idea that I present that I sense of anarchy being part of nonviolence and these four qualities you just mentioned, including empathy and cooperation, mutual aid, equity, that's all part of a compassionate way. Anarchists sometimes say, by me connecting those things, I'm limiting possible strategies for throwing off oppressive power structures. The term that's used these days is they want to have a diversity of tactics to allow for property destruction and other things. What's your sense of that argument and that the connection for you of compassion and anarchy?
Well, I agree that there needs to be a diversity of tactics. And I'm not going to claim that my way is the right way for anybody else. I happen to believe that property destruction is counterproductive to building a new consciousness. But that's my opinion. And I'm not going to say it's the truth. I do believe that the way we conduct ourselves, the way we think, and the way we behave become kind of the models for what we want, whether it's a hostile model or a nourishing model. And I do think that anger, which I experience a lot of, and I actually dealt with my anger, I'm still dealing with it in my therapy, actually, you know, and I've been dealing with this for a long time. Anger is important, but attaching to it has for me at least been very harmful if I attach to anger and hold it. And there's certainly plenty of reasons to be feeling angry at being part of a system that is totally corrupt, totally destructive. We couldn't create a system more anti-life than the United States economic political system, which we call capitalism or democracy, whatever. Of course, it's not a democracy, and there's no free market, really. That's another phony baloney. But there is, in the political system that we grow up with, there is no legitimate avenues for rage or for anger or for legitimate concerns to be expressed. So we have to create the alternative ways of living and the ways of addressing the issues and perhaps avoiding even petitioning. I mean, I'm not sure that petitioning authority is very helpful. In fact, it might be just the opposite. But we do have to think about creating models for, I call it a horizontal versus a vertical model, and that's consistent with anarchism. But I do think that if you feel desperate about, which is easy to feel because the whole system is destroying life at such a rapid rate, including my life and your life, you want to stop it. On the other hand, perhaps we need to think about how we withdraw our support from the system and how deeply entrenched most of us are in feeding the system without really wanting the system to continue. But we do, we have, for most of us, including me, our way of life demands a lot of energy consumption. Even if in my case I think I've reduced it to a great extent, but it's still on a world level, it's not sustainable. And as long as we want to continue our way of life, which means communicating with handheld devices, computers, driving shaped our thought structures and our behavioral patterns, those patterns have to be basically looked at and broken, I believe, because our patterns and our consumption drives the system, despite the fact that the system takes advantage of it and is corrupt and destroys the commons and creates segregated communities. But still, the money and the political drive for our policies, imperial policies, exploitative policies, I believe we have to look and see how we are complicit in it, and therefore the strategy might include how we withdraw our complicity, which means radically downsizing our lives, which a lot of people who are very conscious are working on, but also rebuilding what I would call thousands of relocalized sufficient communities all over the place, so that we're no longer dependent upon centralized systems, which is really a process over time of extrication. Even electricity itself, which requires huge amounts of energy to be burned, basically oil, natural gas, coal, and uranium, those are all very destructive processes. We haven't really thought about it much. The extraction process itself is unsustainable. The manufacturing processes of making all our products is not really sustainable. And so we have been living in this society, 4.6% of the population of the world consuming a quarter to a third of the world's resources. And we're used to that. But that is totally an unsustainable formula, and it has enabled us to live more comfortably than much of the world. We're used to that now. We're probably addicted to it. But it's based on outsourcing all the pain and suffering that is involved in providing us this way of life. And so these are the realities that we need to look at and take seriously. It's one of the reasons I'm hand cycling on my book tour. I don't want to do it by car. And I'm 70 and I'm, considered disabled, but I mean, I can probably do this hand cycling event. At least I'm going to try. And it's just a gesture. It doesn't mean that's the answer. It's just a gesture suggesting breaking some of our habits that really have been built upon the foundation of cheap energy, which is not only exploitive to cultures where the energy is extracted, and it's also polluting the air and the water. And it's basically, you could argue that after World War II, when we lived in the fear of nuclear winter, that our lifestyle, the Western lifestyles themselves, have created what's going to become the nuclear winter equivalent, with carbon molecules going in the air. So we were building weapons to protect our way of life. Our way of life has been killing us. It's just a staggering realization, and if we can grasp that, we have the capacity to make very radical shifts in our consciousness very rapidly. But the consciousness, for me, is more in the feelings, in the visceral part of the body, than it is in the cognitive and the brain.
You know, a couple of things that stood out for me in the book were exactly what you're mentioning now. You write about a certain sort of self-wisdom that has come to you now and again. There's a couple places. One time you write that, "I came to understand that the human body has its own wisdom, one older than the thinking mind." And you also write that we can condition ourselves to be obedient to ideologies, but at some point, our original sacred soul seeks expression. Tell me more about this internal self body wisdom?
Well, I started sensing it about myself first when I was in Ranger training in the military. I was an officer in the Air Force, but I was in a special Air Force ground unit being trained as Rangers, which I didn't really ask for. But part of that training was the typical bayonet training. And during the bayonet training, which was basically a half a day of affixing your bayonets and then screaming kill 100 times and you're plunging it into a dummy and you're doing that over and over again, several rounds of it. My thought process, my cognitive self said, even though I was sensing it, I was really kind of not that excited about doing it. What I would call my brain, my cognitive self, said, just do it. You don't have to like it. Just do it. So just to get through the day. But my arms, just did not want to thrust that M16 with the bayonet on it into the dummy. And I was pretty confident that my brain could overwhelm my arms, my body wisdom, which I came to later call body wisdom. I was pretty sure that I could convince, my cognitive self could convince my body, just do it. You don't have to like it. You don't have to agree to it. You don't have to agree that it's okay, but just do it because you're being ordered to do it, and if you don't do it, you'll be in trouble, and then, you know, you don't know what's going to happen. And well, it just so happened that I was the only person of the 21 officers doing this that was delaying, but I was pretty sure I was going to do it. But the trainer, who was basically screaming in my ear, saying, did you hear the order? Did you hear the order? Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And I was still intending to do it, but he was so angry that he bumped me, not really hard, but he bumped me like an umpire and a manager going at it. And I was enough nervous and off balance that I kind of fell to my knees. And at that point, I knew I was not going to do the bayonet training. Now, many years later, I started reflecting more about that. I wound up graduating from Ranger School and without doing the bayonet training. And then after I became a lawyer in 1972, I had my first case in court, and when the bailiff said, everybody rise, and of course, I had been in court before as a law student, but here I was, the lawyer that was actually representing somebody for the first time. And my body did not want to stand up, but my brain said, just do it. You don't have to like it. Well, it happened three times with three different judges, and the judges were very polite in my cases, in each case, saying, son, seeing that I was a rookie, son, you know, the protocol, you'll rise when the judge enters the courtroom, and I would say yes, sir, because I fully agreed. I fully wanted to comply. My brain wanted to comply. But on the third time that happened, I walked out of the courtroom and never went back. I just decided I didn't want to be a lawyer. And that was another case where I felt that my body was speaking. My viscera, I call it the viscera, was the issues are in the tissues, basically. I felt that my body was speaking so strongly that it somehow it has a wisdom beyond what I'm able to assess intellectually. That this automatic deference to authority is goes against some kind of an archetype. This is not normal or healthy for me. And that's how I came to study a little bit of. It led me to study later. Some of the physicists who were talking about the quantum physicists who were talking about, especially David Bohm, who talked about body wisdom and that thought itself in the Western world, especially in the post-conquest Western world, thought itself is the simply, you have to get beneath the thought patterns and into the body, into the where the memories are in the cells, where the traumas are, where the joyous experiences are. I mean, when you're and I should also say this, that in Vietnam, in a village I was looking, which I write about in the book, I was in a village and that had just been bombed, and I came upon, I was kind of in shock, and I was walking slowly, not even knowing what I was doing, except realizing that something terrible had happened. And I couldn't walk any further because there was a woman at my feet with, I think, three children, and they, and then there were a lot of other bodies beyond that. I couldn't keep walking because there was bodies in the way. And that was a, the woman's eyes were open because the napalm had burnt her eyelids off. Right, terribly emaciated, both her and the children. And but I looked in her eyes, and it was like something went through my body, and it wasn't in my brain. It was in my stomach, in my diaphragm, in my intestines, in my chest. It was like, this woman is my sister. I mean, that's what my head, that's what I would conclude verbally. But it was like, we were one. And there's a chapter in my book called She Is Me. And that was when the Vietnamese lieutenant who was accompanying me asked me what, because I was gagging, I think, and crying, asked me what the problem was, and I said, she's my sister. And that was another case where really, really, this was body wisdom, irreversible knowledge. It's not reversible. It's so deep. You can no longer justify it intellectually that what you're doing is good or okay. So those were examples of experiences over time, reflecting on it all, I realized that this is real wisdom. This is ancient wisdom. It predates all my conditioning, you know. I went to school to learn to be a good, a loyal person in my culture. That started, you know, when I was as a young kid. But my body is reflecting DNA and cultural transmissions of traits and habits that go back literally millions of years. And so I just had to conclude that there was something in me. And I know lots of other people completely understand this, not majority of people, but it was, for me, it was like a startling realization that this is my real self, connected to everything. And I learned something else when I was in school, in graduate school. I learned, you know, how to basically develop a way of thinking that would help me be successful in the United States and make money and say the right things and be well-adjusted. And what I discovered after Vietnam is that I just wasn't very well adjusted. And it was either that I was screwed up or I was actually finding my real self.
I'm speaking with Brian Wilson, longtime peace activist and author of Blood on the Tracks, recently published by PM Press. Brian will be in Santa Cruz at the Capitola Book Cafe on Wednesday, July 20th at 7:30 in the evening. And my name is John Malkin. This program is called The Great Leap Forward. You are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. And we also broadcast simultaneously on the web at freakradio.org. Brian, earlier you were mentioning reading The Kingdom of God is Within You by Tolstoy, and you were talking about reorganizing your life and the potential for reorganizing social structures in a horizontal way and relocalizing, decentralizing. It reminds me a lot of Gandhi and his constructive nonviolence program and Swaraj, self-rule, These ideas that were coming out in India, people making their own clothes, creating their own food and other systems. Tell me about your experiments with localizing your life in terms of food, energy, and so on.
Well, my experiments are very early in their state, because really I'm seeking community. That's the way we're wired. We're wired to be socially cooperative with other people, and we've all been raised, or most of us have been raised, in a society where we're individualists and we're competitors. And so the most I've been able to do, in addition to seeking out other people who are looking for ways to relocalize their lives, is to think about the word contraction. I contract my life geographically, and I relocalize it. So I'm basically expending more energy now in how to actually create local community, and then there's conservation, which is mean frugality and being being conserving resources, conserving your energy, even to be doing the things that are most important. So we grow a lot of our food. We buy the food we don't grow, mostly from people that live not very far from us. And my hand cycle is my primary transportation. So that basically defines my bioregion for the most part. But of course, I can get away with getting in a car and driving because I can do it. I mean, it's there. And I could take Amtrak, and I could take buses and so forth. But most of my travel each week, about 100 to 150 miles, is with my hand cycle. I my errands, I go to meetings, go get groceries. And of course, when you're on the street in a cycle, you're meeting a lot of other people on the street. You don't have a box around you. You're basically you're interacting more. So it's a more interactive mode of travel. And, of course, in Portland, where I live, there's a lot of people who are into local food and relocalization. And so here I am finding many more people who are joining networks of people who are relearning canning, sewing, weaving, in addition to permaculture. So these are just gestures that are moving towards relocalization. And I'm always learning because I'm still a rookie at the age of 70. Since I was so well-conditioned in the system, knowing now that virtually everything I learned, all the assumptions that I learned or still don't even know that I'm living by are all questionable, most of them probably totally fraudulent, really. And so it's like the learning process now is where it's all at. It's like you're learning from your experiences. You're learning from looking. You're learning from listening. You're learning from practicing. You're learning from experimenting. I don't even know if I can pull off this 800-mile cycling trip to San Francisco, but on Saturday morning, I'm going to start, and I'm going to cycle as if I can go from one town to the next, as long as it's about 40 miles. And that, to me, is another example of trying to slow down my life as well as simplify it. But I don't have any great magical formula. I do have, I do know that if we can't create the kind of fulfill our needs without a lot of long distance travel, it's the travel. It's the oil that has enabled us to not think about consequences. We can drive wherever we want, or we can have food shipped in from 1,500 miles away. That's why contraction is important. We have to think about contracting our life into a bioregion so that we then can actually expend our creative energy in relocalizing and recreating communities. Like Gandhi said, building the constructive alternative from below while you're obstructing and non-cooperating with the imperial policy above, you are creating the new society from below. And I still think that's a good model. Think of that maybe as a creating Neolithic villages or early Paleolithic, late Paleolithic villages. That's basically the model. Local, local, local. And we have to learn to that cooperation in essence replaces money. But it's such a radical shift. It's kind of an evolutionary shift of huge proportions, but the stakes are high because we are not living sustainably, and we are facing extinction, or near so. And so the stakes couldn't be any higher. And perhaps there will be a combination of a lot of eco-consciousness. At the same time, there's big die-offs because we will have a lot of die-offs simply because we've enabled human population to jump to almost 7 billion people because of agribusiness, which is based on oil. And when food is grown locally and without chemicals, there's a much more limited amount of mouths that it can feed. And we can't continue just pretending that the Earth doesn't have limits. The Earth is finite, and finite is finite, and we have been living as if it's infinite. And so this is a time. I mean, it really is a evolutionary moment of huge magnitude, and we just happen to be alive witnessing it, and we can be treating it as an opportunity to basically expand our consciousness or rediscover consciousness that we're all connected, and that we are nature. We're part of nature. Therefore, we can't dominate it. We can't separate ourselves from it. And we have to learn from it, or relearn from it, since we divorced ourselves from it several hundred years ago, at least, and maybe a lot longer ago than that, in order to have even modern agriculture or the agricultural revolution from 6,000-7,000 years ago. Perhaps it goes back that far that we got really kind of breached from our primordial connection to our Mother Earth, and therefore we've been maybe astray for 300, 400 generations. And so here we are, kind of not beginning to realize all this, and so we have this opportunity to kind of almost be part of a shift that's absolutely necessary for our survival. Therefore, it may happen, and it may not. But it could happen. We can't rule it out.
Brian, I'd like to pose just one more question with you this evening. In your book, Blood on the Tracks, you write that there came a point where you realized that my own government not only is criminal, but psychotic. And I'd just like to hear a bit about your view on what it is like to be an activist, a social change activist now. You've been engaged for a long, long time. You've been through a lot of different actions. You've traveled a lot. I had forgotten until I read the book that you met Eugene Hasenfuss after he was shot down by the Sandinistas, and that exposed a lot of what was happening at that time. You went through periods where you yourself were targeted by the U.S. government and by the media. You were labeled a terrorist even back in the 80s. And you talk quite a bit about COINTELPRO and programs of the U.S. government to disrupt democratic movements in the United States and activist groups in the United States and abroad. What's your take on all of that in the year 2011? Are you facing any government oppression for your current activities? And how does it compare to earlier periods of activism?
Well, I would say that I'm not doing anything that's active enough to interest the government. For the last 8 years, I've been working on my book, which is somewhat of a sedentary thing to be doing. And the other thing I've been doing is hand cycling. So I've been hand cycling, and that's where I do a lot of my interaction with community members, is actually out in the street on my cycle. I don't even like to use the phone that much, and I definitely do use email, but I don't base my real authentic and interactive life around email. It has to be face-to-face. So I haven't been doing anything that would provoke the government to some kind of anger that I'm aware of. I've been in this period of somewhat tranquility, although I have to say that I've been dealing with my post-traumatic stress disorder in the last 10, 12 years, which I've had to deal with, which has manifested in very strange symptoms. But that has nothing to do with, at this point, with the government. It's just the memories of traumas from both Vietnam and perhaps not just the train, but being shot at in Nicaragua and El Salvador and losing so many friends and so forth. But I probably am getting ready for something else, and I don't know what it's going to be, but I'm really interested in rebuilding creative new human endeavors in the interstices of the existing society. I don't really want to fight the system. I don't want to fight it, but I do want to create new ways. And maybe that ultimately will get me in trouble again with the government. But right now, I'm just disgusted, and I live with the sadness that my country is truly a criminal, psychotic, that has no understanding of the consequences, or if it does have an understanding of the consequences, doesn't care. And that's a psychopath to me. Some people would call it a sociopath, but when you start killing people of this magnitude, I call it a psychopath. And it's almost beyond grasp what our civilization is all about. It's just... I still go to therapy each month, and I have to deal with still processing all the people I've seen killed, and knowing that they were just basically people that were living their lives and were in the way of the U.S. geostrategic policy that crushes anything in its path, including our own people, when we're in the way, like it did with me. It's just so... I just have to work hard to maintain my balance, because it is so incredibly diabolical that it's... if I hadn't had a lot of experiences, I couldn't even sense that it was happening. It's so surreal. But I've had enough experiences to know that, in fact, every day, even as we're speaking now, people are suffering terribly all over the world because they're in the way of some geostrategic interest, usually which the United States is very much involved in pursuing. And that comes back to, again, our way of life, in a sense, is very connected to the government's imperial interest in pursuing those geostrategic interests, even though it's profiting a small group of people. Those people are pursuing energy resources that fuel the Western way of life, which all of us, or most of us at any rate, are part of. And that's where I find it very difficult to figure out how to maneuver through that with other people. It's very challenging. Because I feel my own complicity. Even as I work hard to extricate layers of it. But you can't do it. You can't do it individually, really. It has to ultimately emerge into a widespread movement where people really grasp that we can't keep doing this, and we have to begin sharing and interacting in a new way locally. I can do things that are, I call them gestures, which are okay, but it has to morph into a zeitgeist of some kind where it becomes almost like a Tunisia or an Egypt moment, where people go to the streets because they're ready to say, that's enough. We're not going to take this anymore. We're not going to allow our political economic system with our cooperation to continue crushing others while we are basically being crushed at home, don't even have health care and so forth. So you can't really, in my opinion, you can't create the movement, but you can be working towards a vision that you want to see happen, and if enough people do that, there may come a moment where it's organically the time for a revolution or some kind of an uprising that can't be stopped. Certainly we need it, and we can only say we'll have to see what happens. But we can each day be creating the intention and the behavior that at least is somewhat of an example of simpler living, more radical analysis of the structures and sharing that analysis with others, and helping each other work on what are the solutions, what are the alternatives. Because as much as we're part of the problem, we're also part of the solution. But I think people need more clarity about what the solution is and how each person can be part of that.
Thank you, Brian.
It's not easy to radically simplify our lives, which is the ultimate alternative. That requires a lot of community. And perhaps community will emerge very fast when we no longer have oil. I hope.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you for your clarity and bringing that to us in your book, Blood on the Tracks, and your authenticity and sharing your feelings and your insights and making your life somewhat of an example. I mean, that's how I feel about it. Now you're describing your efforts to localize and simplify your life, and I thank you for that. And we're looking forward to having you here in Santa Cruz again. Brian Wilson, his new book, Blood on the Tracks, has just been published by PM Press. He's beginning a book tour later this week. He'll be in Santa Cruz on Wednesday, July 20th, at the Capitola Book Cafe, reading from the book. And largely your book tour will be via hand-powered bike. And I want to also wish you a happy birthday, Brian, 70th birthday on the 4th of July.
Yeah, thanks. I can't believe it.
Yeah.
Too many birthdays, I guess. Or a lot of birthdays.
How can people, do you have a website people can check out or stay in touch with what you're up to?
Well, I have a tour website called, it's bloodonthetracks.info. So that's a website that can keep track, that can go to find out how the tour is going. And right now, what I have on there is a lot of information that's of interest that will give people a lot of background about the book and the book tour, but also some of my training I've been going through. I've been training for several months for this. And then my own personal website, which has a lot of essays, is brianwilson.com. You have to know Brian Wilson is with two L's. And there's even a Facebook page for the book. I can't believe I've been on Facebook either, but that's the way it is. You can type in Blood on the Tracks on Facebook, and it'll have its own page. And, of course, I have a Facebook page myself with over 4,200 friends, I think. And I'm about ready to scale out of that, but it's been an interesting experience. I use it as a blog.
Great. Brian, thank you very, very much for the book. Thank you for speaking with me this evening on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Well, my pleasure.
Okay, I'll see you when you're in town.
Great.
Paying the Price for Peace is a brand new film about Brian Wilson's life and activism. Come to a screening of the movie on Thursday, September 8th, 2016, at 6 o'clock at Loudoun Nelson Community Center. Brian Wilson will be there as part of the event and will speak before the film screening.